An Armistice by Alice B. Haven. Originally published in Harper's New Monthly Magazine, December 1859. It is safest to begin with a little aversion.
Queer now, isn't it? Somehow I never think of marrying anybody.
Very queer. Why, it's always in my mind, more or less. Whenever you see me rather still and puffing away at the wall, or when I don't talk much going down Broadway of a morning, that's what it is. The two friends walked on a little way in silence, the one who had spoken last looking about him, late as it was, for the face that he always expected to encounter in a crowd, but never had seen thus far. It must be full and round, with blue eyes and a gentle mouth. That was Willard Goodman's beau ideal, and when one knew his home and his mother, there was no longer a doubt as to what had foreshadowed it. His friend was much taller than himself, much more quiet, with a far less sympathetic nature. He came as naturally by his reserve as Willard did by his loving and affectionate heart. He was English-born, and had known no home but a boarding-house since he had been old enough to comprehend the tender watchfulness of a mother's love, or the hearty friendship of a sister. Poor fellow! No wonder that he never thought of marrying. He had no lost Eden to regain.
"There's a good deal in a name," said Willard, slowly taking his eyes from a tantalizing veil that half hid just such a face as he had been thinking of.
"Oh, you don't agree with Miss Julia Capulet, huh?"
"In a wife, I mean. A wife's name. I wasn't thinking about the play last night, though that little witch of a woman was worth looking at. I'm tired of the theater, though. I don't believe if I was married I'd ever go again."
"Yes, you would. Dancing after Madam. Women always want to be showing themselves off in public. That's all they live for."
"How do you like Marion now?"
"Maid Marion? English. And so I like it, of course. Where are you going tonight, Will?"
"To see that cousin of mine. Do come, won't you? I've told her about you."
"No, I thank you." And Edward Chauncey shrugged his broad shoulders. "I'm going... let me see. I don't exactly know where I am going. Down to Astor House for a while, I guess. Come along."
"Not tonight. I promised Helen to look round. I wish she would go. I know so few fellows, and it's mighty dull for her here. She's been accustomed to such stacks of 'em at home."
"Pity she hadn't stayed there. What keeps her north in the winter, anyway? Hanged if I'd stay in this climate a day if I could help it."
"Business," said Will abstractedly. "Lawyers, all that kind of thing. Hasn't got her husband's affairs settled up yet. So this year, it's been hanging on 3 or 4 now, she's going to have things wound up."
"Indeed. There it is again."
And the shoulders were shrugged, evidently in contempt this time.
"If there is anything I do hate, it's a widow. Women of all kinds are bad enough. Don't amount to anything. But a widow? Well, she goes a little beyond anything. No, I thank you."
And Mr. Chauncey walked on as his friend ascended the steps of a fashionable boarding-house and rung the bell.
"Mrs. Balsall?"
"Oh, certainly. Mrs. Balsall was in her own parlor. Would the gentleman walk up?" She was not only in the parlor, but in the dumps, as she assured her cousin when she had kissed him, as she always did. Whatever faults Helen Balsall might have had, prudery was not one of them. Such a horrid cold as she had, it was enough to give anyone the blues. Such a horrid wind, and so cold. Ugh! And she shivered for all the sea-coal fire, and wound a crimson scarf around her neck. Find her north another year! "I'm glad that Ned didn't come in, then," said the sympathizing cousin, wishing he knew what it was Mother always prescribed for such colds.
"Ned? Ned who?
No, a visitor was the last thing she wanted to see."
"He's a good fellow, though, let me tell you now.
But queer, very queer. I think all Englishmen are, somehow."
"Englishmen?"
retorted the lady from behind the little embroidered handkerchief held between the fire and her flushed face.
If there's anything I do hate, it's an Englishman.
Now, that's odd. And Will Goodman's face lighted up with the singular coincidence.
That's just exactly what he said when I asked him to come and see you.
Did he? Cool, certainly. What does he know about me?
Why, I told him you were a widow, you see, not a day over 22, and most men would have jumped at the chance of an introduction. I know plenty. But you see, that's the kind I wouldn't bring here. Ned hates widows as he does, well, a landlady, say.
Does he? Well, he's welcome to keep his distance. And it was plain, from the proud way the lady's head rose up, that her wrath was genuine. What if she was a widow? Dear knows she couldn't help it. Hadn't she cried her eyes out on black-bordered pocket handkerchiefs for 2 years, which was a great deal to do, considering the difference in age between herself and the late lamented, and that he had left her quite comfortable and independent of all mankind, English or otherwise? There were plenty of men that did not hate widows, but admired them and adored them. And then she looked at the card basket and the letter rack, and felt consoled at the slight this stranger had put upon her when she saw how full both were.
"About this Thanksgiving business, Will," she said presently. "Your mother insists upon my coming, and I've got this horrid cold. How in the world can I go?"
"It's Boneset!" cried out this kind young fellow just at that moment. "Boneset, Coz! It'd cure you right up. If we were only out home now, mother always has it on hand." And he paused in perplexity, forgetting that most apothecaries followed his mother's example in that respect.
"Oh, I hate herb tea. Mom Cressy has dosed me ever since I was so high. I don't think I can go at all, for my eyes are all swollen out of my head, and my voice is as thick, well, I don't know it when I hear it. I'm sorry to disappoint Aunt Grace, or to lose her Thanksgiving dinner, tell her. But you'd better write that I can't come. I don't feel like stirring away from the fire."
"But you must, Helen. That's just what I came to see about. I'm going up Wednesday, and they all expect you. Mother set her heart upon it, and you know she's just as fond of you as if you were her own child. Why, there's nothing she wouldn't do for you."
What was there that she had not done already for her brother's only child? Helen thought of the long journey undertaken past middle age, and Aunt Grace had ever been a homebody, to comfort her in her heavy trouble 3 years before, the trouble that had left her orphaned and widowed within 1 year. No wonder that when she thought of the independence which many envied, she only sighed.
"Well, Willie, if Auntie has set her heart on it, I must go, that's all. But you don't know how I dread it. This cold goes through and through me, and how I am to live when snow comes, I don't see."
"I don't think you'll mind it so much then. It never seems half as cold when there's snow on the ground. I hope we shall have snow while we're up at Edge Hill. We do sometimes when Thanksgiving comes so late."
"Do you think we will? Oh, that would be famous. Think I never have had a sleigh ride. What train on Wednesday?"
And there was far more animation in the inquiry than the languid invalid had shown before. But then, we all know what a cold is. A cold in the head, what need be said, uglier, stupider, more ill-bred. Mr. Chauncey had not found the Astor House quite as pleasant as usual, apparently. He had reached home before his roommate, and was luxuriating in a tumbler of something, the covered pitcher in lemon skin said what, and a fresh London Times. It was a bachelor's apartment, large enough to accommodate a bookcase, a music stand. The flute lay on the rack at that moment. He had indulged his next-door neighbor with, "Nanny, wilt thou gang wi' me?" on his return home. There was a large engraving of the gracious queen over his bed, holding the place occupied by a pencil drawing of a pleasant matronly face, Aunt Grace, you may be sure, over her son's pillow, at the other end of the room. Edward Chauncey had tastes, and his books and easel and flute had saved him from not a little wickedness in his day. "Saw Jones down at the Astor, and he can't take that run on Long Island with me, old boy. What do you say?
Suppose I go home with you and try a Connecticut Thanksgiving after all.
Was ever goodwill so taxed? Will Goodman's ingenuity never had been before. He had given his friend a general invitation to his father's house for the last 2 years. He had urged him to spend this very holiday there, before he knew of the previous engagement with young Jones. But now Helen had concluded to go, and they would never get along at all. They could both say such cutting things, and it would keep the house in hot water. As it happened, his roommate did not notice his rueful visage at the moment, or the hesitating voice in which the "Oh, yes, certainly," was uttered. He was too busily occupied in replenishing the slender pitcher before mentioned. Otherwise, his ever-ready pride would have taken fire. As it was, he flung the lemon skins into the grate and considered it a settled thing. Having evaded an explanation on the start, Will Goodman deferred it from time to time, and finally concluded to take the chances. It was a little cowardly, of course, but he delighted in his friend, and he loved his cousin. He did not want to offend either. You would have done just the same.
I should, at all events. "What takes you downtown, though?" inquired Mr. Chauncey the morning of their departure. He was in a great state of preparation, having overlooked his guns and fishing tackle and selected a choice assortment, late as the season was, in the hope of some sport. There was also a tin can for botanizing. Fine opportunity, the last of November in Connecticut woods. And the flute, but that was Will's idea, slipped into its Morocco traveling case, and was deposited into one of the innumerable pockets of a rough overcoat, showing great originality of construction and an evident collusion of the owner and his tailor.
"Downtown? Oh, a little business engagement." And his companion's face, all unused to diplomacy, flushed guiltily. "I'll meet you at the upper depot in good time."
"Off with you, then," said the bluff, hearty tones of the unsuspicious woman-hater, who polished his stocks and oiled his locks with great enthusiasm and a few musical interludes, in high good humor with himself and all the world. For he did not often take holiday. The warehouse of Trenholm, Robertson & Company, in which he was junior partner, seldom closed its great gates, and his desk was never empty. Will Goodman looked about for his compagnon de voyage as the cars came slowly towards the upper depot. By his side was a muffled, and in consequence, a rather ungraceful figure, consisting, as far as could be seen, of a cloak, blanket shawl, fur tippet, and a huge muff crowned by a close velvet traveling hat and an expansive green barège veil, really intended for use and not in the least picturesque, like the brown and blue semicircles that leave the tips of pretty little noses to freeze in the cold wind.
"What in the world makes you so uneasy, Will? You'll have your foot right into my basket. There, I told you so. And all those meringues from Mallard's will be in a pretty condition. There you go again, bobbing up and down. I declare you'll have my veil off, and I wouldn't have anybody but you see me such a figure for the world." Poor Will, a guilty conscience is proverbially a goad, and just then he had caught sight of a tall figure laden with sportsman's equipments, and beckoning to him to come forward and take half of an appropriated seat.
"One minute, Manel, I want to speak to a friend of mine." And the wondering lady watched her escort as he joined the new arrival and went through an interesting little pantomime. Evidently she was pointed out. Both gentlemen looked toward her, and Will certainly pointed that way. The tall stranger shook his head, clear enough to decline the introduction her cousin had evidently proffered. And if he had not been a gentleman, she would have said that the lowering look that came over his face as he stretched himself out over the seat was ill-tempered. It was very decided annoyance at finding himself sold. That was his expression. And if the cars had not been in motion, he would have beat a precipitate retreat. But much as he disliked the idea of being shut up in a country house with a woman that would be expecting all sorts of attentions, confound it, and a widow into the bargain, He loved his precious limbs too well to attempt a flying leap, and so he sat still and sulked, Englishman as he was. "Who's that, pray?" asked the lady pettishly, as her rather crestfallen cavalier returned.
"Only my English friend, that you've often heard me speak of."
"Declines the pleasure of my acquaintance, does he? Oh, you needn't say a word. I saw it all for myself. He needn't have distressed himself. No one's going to carry him off."
"How far is he going?" she added abruptly.
"As far, well, about 40 miles, you know. It's 40 miles to Edgehill, isn't it?"
"Well, Helen, that man isn't going to your father's."
"I believe he is."
"Well, I shall not, that's all. You may just stop at the next station."
"Yes, you may, and I'll go back to New York by myself. I'm not going to have my Thanksgiving and my Aunt Grace spoiled by that sulky, wretched-looking Englishman. I declare, Will, if it wasn't in the cars, I could box your ears."
And she looked at the moment as if the exercise would have relieved her. But when she found that they were on an express train, which did not stop for more than 2/3 of the way, she gradually quieted down, as her cousin knew she would, and made other arrangements. Not the less hostile to the intruder, however.
3 o'clock of a dark, gloomy November afternoon when they neared the station. Will Goodman began to recognize landmarks and dreaded the first collision between his forces. There was a long ride before them still, 7 miles to Ryefield, and very likely only a covered wagon sent for them. How in the world was he to stow Helen's 2 trunks, those awkward-looking fowling pieces, their respective carpet bags, and the 2 belligerents?
Rather coldish, he said in an indifferent kind of way, as he went forward and stood clinking the brass checks on the back of the seat his friend still continued to occupy.
"I say, Will, all that her baggage? How are we going to the farm? I don't relish being jammed into close quarters."
"Oh, there'll be a wagon or something. They don't know you're coming, you see, or they would have sent the big one. As it is, we shall have to be amiable, and you must put your feet in your pocket."
"How far from the farm is the next station?"
"Just about as far as this. We sometimes go that way. Ryefield lies at the point of an angle, so, between the two. But this is the best road."
"Well, I'll try the other anyhow. It's likely I can get a vehicle of some kind, and I want to see the country." Obstinate to the last, even Will Goodman felt provoked at his pertinacity, and suffered him to go his own way with very faint remonstrance. Besides, it helped him out of the present difficulty, though he said nothing to Helen as he assisted her to the platform and went to hunt up his father's man Jacob.
"They've sent plenty of buffalo robes, you see, Helen, and I'll get a hot brick for you before we start. Here, let me tuck this down a little. I'll sit on the front seat with Jacob."
"Where is your friend?" inquired Helen, as the preparations for their drive were made without reference to him. With feminine daring, she was eager now for the encounter, and it needed none of Will's explanations or apologies to help her to understand that she was most openly and ungallantly avoided. She had thought before to wound the self-love of the individual in question. The exposure of the ride was scarcely noticed in planning a complete subjugation. Her benumbed faculties were wonderfully quickened. She had not felt so like herself since the cold began. The hospitable doors of the wide brown farmhouse were thrown open to receive them, and Aunt Grace herself almost lifted Helen from the vehicle, shawls and all.
"You poor child, you! Out in such a day! Ain't you most frozen? Do come right in. There, let me take your basket for you. You run right in by the fire, and down sick with a cold to start with. Father, here's Helen after all. Your uncle would have come for you himself, but he strained his wrist somehow last week and ain't been fit to drive since. Never mind, we'll nurse you up and make you all right again. I've got plenty of bone set in the garret chamber."
"You never saw any such weather as this, I reckon, Helen. Beats Georgia, don't it?" And Uncle Goodman kissed her on both cheeks. "Fresh as a rose. "La, mother, she ain't going to die yet a while."
"No, indeed," laughed the newcomer gaily. "I've lost my cold in the cars, and don't intend to find it again."
"Hadn't you better come right upstairs now and lay off your things," said Aunt Grace, working away at the strings of the deep velvet bonnet.
"Come now. I had a fire made up in the spare room, for I knew how you'd feel the cold. You run right up, and I'll step into the kitchen and bring you a cup of tea. Supper ain't just ready, and a cup of tea is wonderful comforting after a journey."
"Why, Willard, how do you do, my boy?"
And Helen, halfway up the stairs, looked over the balusters to see the hearty greeting between mother and son. It did her good. So did the cup of tea, which Aunt Grace prepared just as she liked it, and brought up with her own hands. And when she had brushed out her curls, and shaken the creases from her black silk traveling dress, and smoothed her neat linen collar with its crimson bow, she had a southerner's taste for all warm, bright coloring, the heavy-eyed, pettish invalid had quite disappeared in the gay and elegant woman that took up her station to the right of the cheerful fire in the parlor below, chatting so fast and so brightly with her dear northern friends, whose heartiness and affectionateness always made her so at home among them, she had not forgotten the dreary traveler approaching. He came at last, just as Aunt Grace began to get uneasy about her supper, chilled and forlorn enough after his solitary ride, so benumbed outwardly and inwardly that he scarcely heard the introductions Will accomplished laboriously, and was glad to find himself alone with his roommate in an upper chamber.
"By George, Will," and his face emerged from behind one of Aunt Grace's snowy towels, "I felt like a fool. Why didn't you tell me there was a young lady staying here?"
"A young lady who?"
"Why, the one by the fire. I just took one look, but she's a stunner. Handsome eyes, hasn't she? Look a man right through. Lots of fun in her. Who is she?"
"Oh, Helen. Well, that's clever."
And the preliminary flourish of the descending hairbrush was arrested halfway by such a shout of laughter that Helen heard it in the parlor, and Aunt Grace, busied with her biscuits and chickens, in the kitchen. Such a supper it was, too, as only Ryfield Farm could furnish. Thanksgiving wasn't the time to stint in anything, was the doctrine that governed the household, and Helen found that she had recovered her appetite as well as her good looks, and being perfectly conscious of the latter, gave herself up to her uncle's pleasant, though not particularly novel, jokes, and her aunt's fond petting. As for Mr. Chauncey, he tried to keep up his wonted reserve at first, but the frost melted in the fire of so much kindliness, and he niched himself into the family circle in a manner that was remarkable to Willard Goodman, who had dreaded the impression that the stiff, rather formal manner habitual to him when embarrassed might create. The evening slipped away, and 11 o'clock came before the circle formed round the parlor fire after tea had been broken. There were nuts and apples. "Nuts are such sociable things," remarked Aunt Grace, "and sweet cider sparkling and creaming like champagne in the old-fashioned cut-glass tumblers." "You might as well bring the big Bible, Will," said his mother, as he took his cousin's empty glass. "We must be up bright and early in the morning to get to church in season."
It was the first thing that had jarred on the stranger since he entered the household. He had been so long away from all parental restraint that he had shaken off the recollection of its better influences also, and had lost sight of, if not wholly broken, the tie that binds every soul to its father. But courtesy forbade that he should show how irksome the proposition seemed, and he began, with his artist's eye, to note the grouping of the picture before him. The open Bible spread up out upon the stand, the two lights burning before it, and the venerable head bowing down to the sacred page. Aunt Grace straightening her figure unconsciously and folding her plump hands before her. Willard listening with habitual attention, his fine face deepening into thoughtfulness. And Helen gazing at the firelight, her eyes shaded by her slender white hand. He began to think he would go to church after all the next day, though he had not been before in many years. He was glad of it afterward, when he found himself seated close to the lady he had so churlishly avoided only the day before.
She looked very radiant in the pink hat and plumes that emerged from one of the trunks, and the ample cashmere shawl that swept in such admirable folds about her tall figure. The russet-colored gloves were just the shade he preferred, and fitted exactly, and there was the faintest breath of heliotrope whenever she moved the handkerchief held so lightly between them. Radiant was the word that came most naturally to his mind when he first encountered her in the hall, dressed for church, and he repeated it to himself whenever he turned that way. It was not so much the sermon that impressed him, though that was an earnest, grateful appeal to those who listened to number the blessings of the year and of their whole lives and be thankful for them, but the psalm with its exulting chorus. No change of time shall ever shock my firm affection, Lord, to thee, for thou hast always been my rock, a fortress and defense to me. And the clear voice of the singer nearest to him, whose hand rested on the time-worn hymn-book, which she held out with a gesture that signified her expectation that he would join. And he did so, moved by the choral harmony that rose and swelled around him, wondering at himself all the while, and at the deep earnestness that impressed them. There must be something real after all in a belief and a worship that took such deep root in the heart. He found himself wondering over it many times that day. There was no contradiction in the merriment of the evening. All was cheerfulness, as became those whose hearts and lives were purely thankful. The gathering in the parlor included Will's two married brothers and their families, cousins, and friends, all of whom were sufficiently at home to say Aunt Grace and to banish every particle of formality. They sang, they jested, and though the shade of Puritanism was the only shadow there and forbade a dance, they played rustic games that were still more mirthful and quite new to the two guests. They were not afraid of linked hands and even a kiss, these honest folk, and the blushes and pretty confusion caused by forfeits and pawns were no cover for perverted hearts and sullied imaginations. The merriment went on, and the only two who had been spectators were drawn into it. "What is it? What is it?" called out Helen, rightly, as she came flying out into the hall to redeem a forfeit from the wretched Englishman. There was no light there but that which came through the half-open parlor door behind which he stood. It revealed her rose-red cheeks and tangled curls, her eyes dancing with fun and frolic. She put out her hand in the dusky shadow to find him. "How am I to pay the porter?" she said again, merrily. "It is all new to me." "And to me, too," he said. But he took pay as he had been bidden. He had not intended to, but he could not help the irresistible impulse. They were alone in the shadow, dangerously near, and she held out her hand to him. He took it, took them both, and held them so tightly that she almost screamed. And then he kissed her full on those red lips. And Helen stood still for one moment, blushing, frightened, but most of all at her own traitor's heart that did not resent it, and then went flying up the stairs to stand alone in the darkness of her own room and wonder how it had all come about.
"It's most time the young folks were home," said Aunt Grace, walking to the window with her knitting. "Don't you think so, Father?"
"Don't hurry him, though talking won't do it, for that matter."
And Mr. Goodman yawned and stretched out his feet to the glowing coals on the hearth.
"But I don't mean to sit up. They can look after themselves, I reckon. Helen's able to any day. How that young Englishman has come round, though. Willard told me the first night they came that he was so very topping he didn't know how Helen and he would get along. I haven't seen anything of it, I must say. He seems to me very much like other folks."
"Guess they'll do," said Aunt Grace quietly, leaning against the sash and looking out upon the shadow of the barns on the new-fallen snow. Such moonlight and such snow, and the weather had moderated so that one might say, such sleighing. Helen was having her first sleigh ride.
"They'll want something to eat when they do get here," she added presently, ever on hospitable thought intent. "So don't wait for me.
I'll just step to the pantry and see what I can find." Mr. Goodman had already deposited himself on the billowy feather bed that displayed its inviting outline and snowy counterpane in the downstairs bedroom, when the quick jangle of bells announced the return of the first of the party. Aunt Grace looked out of the pantry window, but went quietly on with her preparations, and a significant nod as she held communion with herself over the pie dish. She had left a light in the parlor, and they could wait till she came. The front door never was locked half the time, and wasn't now, anyway. She forgot that Mr. Goodman had taken his departure since, and the lamp had vanished with him. But there was a cheerful red light from the fire, and Helen made her way toward it, and leaned her head down upon the mantel. She stood there without turning round, when a heavier shadow fell out into the room.
"You have forgiven me?"
And an arm was passed lightly around her, the hand resting on the mantel very near her face.
"You? Yes, it's myself I have to forgive now."
And the thoughtful look passed away, and the old defiance lighted up her eyes again.
"Children," said Aunt Grace, coming toward them with her loaded tray. "There, I've brought you something to eat, but there's only one plate, I find. However, I guess you wouldn't mind much if there was only one fork, too, for 'pears to me you've about made up your minds to eat out of one dish for the rest of your lives."
The end.